Chapter 24. Purge 2 engages. A silent revolution. Datso's triumph. They came through the plant growth along the silver paths, blasting, men clad in the stained uniforms of the 50th Gudrunite Rifles and the black armor of the Naval Security Detail. Two of the Gudrunites in my squad toppled and fell from the path, their corpses disappearing into the oily waters of the tanks below. But most of the enemy gunfire was going wild. Purge 2 countered, lasguns barking. I moved to the front of the group and began firing my bolt pistol. There was precious little room for maneuver on the silver walkway, and even less cover. My first shot went wide, so wide I wondered if the bolter was misaligned. Then I remembered the devious nature of the Ceruthi tetrascape, and compensated. Two shots, two satisfying hits. Beckwin and Midas both had the trick of it too, and Yerusis' boys were learning. Gilar made a lot of noise, ripping through the gardens with his storm bolter, but it seemed to me he was still discomforted by the environment. It was a salutary moment, to see one of the godlike warriors I have regarded with great awe ever since the day, 30 years ago, when I watched the White Scars take Almanadai, become fallible. For all his power, courage, superhuman vigor, and advanced weapons, he was achieving nothing, whereas Yelton, the youngest of the Gudrun boys, had made 3 kills already. Was it arrogance? Overconfidence in his own abilities? Gila! Brother Gila! Adjust your fire! I heard him curse something about insolence and move ahead down the path, detonating plant bulks with his shots.
Why doesn't the bastard listen?
Midas complained, sighting his Glavian rifle and decapitating a heretic trooper at 100 meters.
Close up! I ordered. Yerus, frag them!
Yerus and 3 others began to lob frag grenades over the thickets. Explosive flashes blew water ooze and vegetable matter up from the tanks, and the air became foggy with plant fiber and sappy moisture. There was an abrupt change in tone in the enemy fire. The boom of a bolter rang out over the crack and snipe of the laser weapons. I looked down the silver path in time to see Gilard jerk backwards as multiple bolter rounds struck his chest plate. With a cry of rage rather than pain, he went over, off the path, into the bubbling water of the tank behind us, and vanished. Thrusting the heretic foot soldiers out of the way, his killer came down the pathway towards us.
"Oh, no!" Beckwin cried. "Please, by the Golden Throne, no!"
Another of the Emperor's children, the brother, if not the twin, of Foul Mandragore. His scintillating cloak blew out behind him, and his steel-shod hooves shook the path. He was bellowing like a bull auroch. His bolter spat, and the Gudrunite beside me burst apart. The children of the Emperor, shadowy sponsors of this entire enterprise, were here to protect their investment. Had they come unbidden after Mandragore's death? Had Datso or Locke summoned them? I fired the bolter at him, joining the fusillade of desperate weapons blasts that Purge 2 leveled in a frantic attempt to slow him down. Fear made the men forget the best of their training, and many of the shots were wild. He didn't seem to feel those few that struck his armor.
"Purge 2! This is Purge 2! The children of the Emperor are here!" I yelled into my vox. I knew I would be dead in an instant. It was imperative that Fleet Command knew of this dire development.
A black shape burst up from the dark water, cascading froth and ooze in all directions. Brother Gilar slammed into the Chaos Marine, wrenching him over, and they both fell thrashing into the adjacent tank. Something, probably the heretic's bolter, fired repeatedly underwater, and the side of the tank below the floating path splintered out in a rush of liquid. The soupy water flooded out, draining away into the gullies between the garden structures. As the fluid level dropped, the titanic combatants emerged, blackened with mire, wrestling and trading inhuman blows among the tangled roots and feeder tubes of the tank's murky bottom. Ceramite-cased fists pounded into armor plates. Chips of plasteel flew from the impacts. The Chaos Marine's vast paws clawed at Gilar, tearing at his visor and shoulder guards. Gilar drove him backwards, his feet churning in the shallow, thick water. They slammed in the bowl of a cycad. The enemy grappled, getting a better grip, stabbing a jagged gauntlet spike through the armpit seal of the Death Watch's Imperator armor. Gilar staggered, and as he fell back, a massive backhanded slap knocked him over and tore his helmet off. The Chaos Marine landed on the sprawling Gilar, tearing at his throat, driving fists like boulders into his face. There was a bang of weapon discharge and a flash. his face destroyed, and his collapsed skull burning from the inside. The chaos filth fell back into the swamp water. Gilar rose unsteady, his storm bolter in his hand, blood pouring from the wounds in his face and neck. It was a formidable victory. Yerus and his men cheered and whooped, and then renewed their advance on the remaining heretics. The enemy, resolve lost, pulled back and vanished into the dense thickets of the gardens. Dripping, Gilar climbed back onto the path and looked down at me. "I'm glad you're still with us, Brother Gilar," I said. We traced the paths on through the gardens of the Ceruthi, unopposed. The enemy dead we passed, floating in the tanks or sprawled on the pathways, had signs of branding on their faces. Chaos marks, burned into the skin by evil rather than heat. Admiral Spatian had hoped that some of the heretic forces, especially the Gudrunite Imperial Guard, might yet be restored to the Imperial cause. Like Yerus and his men, most had been unwilling pawns caught up in Estrom's treason, and the fleet tacticians had presented models of victory wherein Locke and Datso found the bulk of their ground forces turning against them. Such a hope was dashed. The minds of these good men had been burned away and poisoned by chaos. The heretics had enforced the loyalty of their stolen armies. Via Tetragates we advanced, passing through six more garden spheres, then on into wide tiled courtyards and halls of asymmetrical pillars whose function we could not imagine. Twice we had brief skirmishes with heretic forces, driving them back into the warped cavities of the edifice. More often we could hear ferocious war, full-blown battles that seemed right at hand, but of which there was no visual or physical trace. Contact with Fleet Command was fragmentary. Purge One, Lord Rawkin's party, was locked in combat somewhere, and nothing had been heard of Molitor's Purge Four. Shongard's group, Purge Five, was lost somewhere in the Tetrascape. Plaintive calls for aid came from them at irregular intervals, piteous half-sane ramblings about impossible spaces and spirals of madness. From Titus Endor we heard nothing. The main surface war still raged. Maiapois commanders reported gains along the firelegs that edged the target edifices, one of which was reportedly beginning to implode, as if great harm had been done to it internally. In a vault of smooth polished beige that seemed to us to have no ceiling, we found our first Ceruthi. They were dead, a dozen of them, their grey bulks split and mauled, silver stilts torn off. Through the next gate lay a spiral room littered with 100 more. Moving among the grey dead, their pallid limbs dripping with ichor, were several of the white slave beasts that had carried the Necrochuke onto the plateau. They seemed to me to have broken free, as many dragged their wire restraints. Some had taken up silver stilts and were stabbing them slowly and repeatedly into the corpses of their grey masters. I wondered if the pitiful white things were a separate race, enslaved by the Ceruthi, or a bastardized mutant caste kept in servitude. The invasion, it seemed, had freed them to turn on their owners and butcher them. Such is the price of slavery, sooner or later. The slave things offered us no threat. They didn't even appear to notice the humans moving amongst them. With silent, methodical determination, they mutilated the bodies of the Ceruthi. In another chamber, an oval dish with tessellated tiles and a strangely warm atmosphere, living Ceruthi milled aimlessly in their hundreds. Some had lost stilts and were limping. Others lay in trembling masses, their skulls flopped back on their bodies. The smell of licorice, or whatever it was, reeked here. As we watched, white slave things lumbered into the chamber through another tetragate and began to twist apart and maul the Ceruthi, one by one, with the calm, methodical motions of insects. The Ceruthi offered no resistance. This story was repeated in other chambers and curving halls. Ceruthi lay dead or meandering without purpose, freed slaves finding them by touch and dismembering them. I wonder, even now, as to the meaning of these alien scenes. Had the Ceruthi given up, resigned to their doom, or had some other circumstance stolen their will to live and resist? Not even the tech priests or the xenobiologists could provide an answer. There is, ultimately, only the fact of their alien nature, abstract, inscrutable, and beyond the capacity of the human mind to fathom. When we found the archpriest Datso, he was close to death. A battle of titanic proportions had taken place in the tetrascape where he lay. Thousands of dead lay on the tiled floor, Maiapua infantry and heretic troops alike. Two children of the Emperor and three Death Watch were among the fallen. The tetrascape, by far the largest of any we had seen in the edifice, reached away beyond the curve of all human dimensions, and the jumbled corpses covered the endless floor into infinity. Datso lay at the foot of an asymmetrical block that rose from the tiles like a standing stone. His body was torn by gunshot wounds. Heldane sat nearby, his back to the great block, guarding the archpriest with an auto pistol. Heldane's torso was smirched in blood, and his breathing was labored. He saw us approach through the tetragate and lowered the gun weakly. "What happened here, Heldane?"
"A battle," he said, wheezing. "We came upon it as it was raging. When Inquisitor Endor saw this wretch, he drove us into the fight to reach him. It was a blur after that."
"Where's Endor?" I asked, looking around, hoping I would not see his corpse among the dead.
"Gone. Gone after Locke."
"Which way?" He pointed weakly to a tetra gate on the far side of the sea of bodies. "Does Locke have the Necrotuke? The Ceruthi Necrotuke, I mean."
"No,"
Haldane said.
"But he has the primer."
"The what?"
"Datso got it out of this thing somehow," he said,
slapping the stone block that supported him.
"A language primer. A translation tool. Without it, the Ceruthi version of the text is unreadable to us."
"How in the Emperor's name did he do that?"
Gilar asked.
"With his mind,"
Haldane said.
"Can't you feel that afterburn of the psychic effort?"
I found that I could. The mental taste of a mind almost burned out. The raised block was clearly another part of the Ceruthi's mysterious technology, perhaps the equivalent of an imperial cogitator, perhaps something more sentient, even something alive. Datso, whose psychic abilities I already knew to be monstrous, had identified it and psychically assaulted it, forcing it to give up its secrets. An extraordinary feat of the mind, a triumph of will.
"A polyhedron," Haldane added. "Irregular, small, made of pearl, it seemed to me. It just came out of the block into his hands. Materialized. I saw it happening as I fought my way to them. But the effort destroyed his mind. Endor cut him down. He hadn't the strength to resist."
"How do you know it was this primer?" asked Beckwin.
"I read it in his dying mind. Like I said, there is no resistance left there. See for yourself."
I crossed over to Datso and knelt next to him. Ragged breathing sucked in and out of his bloody mouth. I drove my mind into his, pushing aside pathetic strands of denial, and confirmed Haldane's story. With inhuman willpower, Datso had wrenched the language primer from the Ceruthi technology, and with it the whereabouts of the Xenos Necrotuke. Dying, he had passed both to Locke to finish the task.
"Gregor,"
Midas hissed. I turned. Far away, across the curve of the tetrascape, heretic troops were advancing through the dead. They began firing at us. Gilar and the Gudrunites fired back, taking what cover they could to resist.
"Brother Gilar, I need you to hold these bastards at bay."
"Where are you going, Inquisitor?"
he asked, sliding a fresh clip into his storm bolter.
"After Locke and Endor. To do what I can."